There was a night last week when I was awake at 3 a.m. It tends to happen a lot recently. Basically, ever since coronavirus happened and I lost my job and had to adapt to a way of life that meant not working all hours of every single day. If you ask chefs and cooks, that's been one of the weirdest and oddest things to get used to is having time off. Mandatory and hopefully healthy time off. It was 3 a.m. and I was endlessly scrolling through news and Twitter and Instagram and back to Twitter. It was all really the same things that you're reading about. Death tolls rising, countries doing whatever they can, and for some reason, idiotic protesters in the States have convinced themselves that the coronavirus is a hoax and a demonic political plot started by Democrats to keep Trump from getting reelected. It was there on Twitter that I saw the news story, risk of hunger pandemic as COVID-19 set to almost double acute hunger by the end of 2020. I feel like at every moment when I'm reading news, the thought is always in the back of my head that I need to find stories for the podcast, but they usually somehow find me. It's how I stumbled upon lots of stories for the show, too many to really mention. But what I stumbled on by clicking that article and being taken to the World Food Program's website was one that, honestly, I was not really prepared for. It led me to reach out to Julie Marshall, the person that I spoke to on Tuesday. She is the communications officer for the World Food Program. And she began to take me down the path of trying to understand what the World Food Program is, what it's trying to do, and how we chefs can help. Speaking of chefs, especially us in the modern and first world, we all live in a kind of strange vortex. One of having the best ingredients available at all times, the best food, and lots of it. I don't ever remember sitting and saying to myself, well, I hope the salmon actually comes in, or I hope the potatoes make it here so I can serve them. We have access to food. We live in a world of opulence and one of extremes. When I ran the kitchen of the Bourbon Bar, the restaurant that kind of put me and Tim on the map, I quite literally ate foie gras, venison, cured meats, mostly every single day. I was surrounded by the finest cheese, the finest meat, the finest wine, the most beautiful produce I had ever seen, every single day. And it's easy to ignore the fact that there are millions and millions and millions of people who are starving and who are in very real danger of dying from hunger. Now, I don't want you to sit there and listen to me and worry that this is some kind of Sarah McLachlan commercial, like In the Arms of the Angels. I don't want you to sit there and think that this is going to be a doom and gloom podcast, because it's not. We are all feeling the effects of doom and gloom. But I am going to warn you and say that this podcast will make you think that maybe your problems are not quite as big as you have thought before this. Hunger is real. Starvation is real. And I am so honored to now not only be able to introduce you to Julie Marshall and the World Food Program, but also let you know that I will be doing whatever I can to continue working with them in any capacity to try and bring awareness to the absolutely astounding work that they do. Before we get into the conversation with Julie, I want to remind you to please follow the World Food Program on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and please share their posts, share their stories. They feed 30 million people every day, and their work is now more important than ever because coronavirus is threatening to bring the number of people facing starvation to 250 million by the end of the year. Now, please sit back and listen to my conversation with Julie Marshall and the World Food Program.
Let's sort of start about who WFP is. So the World Food Program is the largest humanitarian agency in the world. We reach around 100 million people with food assistance, working in 80 different countries. So we reach people with food in lots of different ways, whether that's emergency relief, where we're literally saving lives, where people don't have a choice, they don't have any other food. School feeding programs, where we're feeding kids in school, encouraging girls into schools. Food for work programs, where communities are actually changing and improving their own infrastructure in their own communities as we're supplying either food or cash assistance as they're doing that, so they can then help themselves. And of course, helping refugees all around the world who just, you know, in some cases don't have a choice or ability to go support themselves. So we're a large organization, and what we looked at last year was we could see there was around 135 million people who are severely hungry. That's not people that are just hungry. This is people that don't know where their next meal is coming from. Wow. So that number globally, it's growing. It's getting bigger. And that's happening over the last couple of years. So what we could see is that the reason the numbers were growing was really down to conflict. So we could see that about 60% of our resources were going towards conflict-affected areas, places like Yemen, where we're feeding around 12.5 million people every month, Syria, South Sudan. And those places aren't really going to get any better until we get peace in some of those areas.
Right.
And then we could also see the effect of climate change. So as we could see severe weather patterns, wiping away crops, destroying livelihoods, people were becoming hungry. So that was, you know, something that was happening over time as well, adding again to our numbers. And then, of course, economic downturns as people become poorer, they don't have the livelihoods. Even in urban areas, they were turning to their governments or looking to for support from WFP. So we could see that this year was expected to be one of the worst years since the World War II.
Wow.
So we were expecting a bumper year, if you like, for, which is, you know, an awful thing to say. So
yeah.
135 million people severely hungry. But then COVID hits. So what we could see there and what we've been looking at with our estimations and our people on the ground is we're looking at an extra 130 million people that will be severely hungry. Again, just not knowing where their next meal is coming from.
Jesus.
So we're, I mean, that's a quarter of a billion people. This is you know, it's unheard of. Not in this day and age. There's enough food on the planet to feed people. We just need to have access and funding. So this is where it could go. This is the numbers that we're looking at. And out of that 100 million people that we reach, around 30 million of them are totally dependent on WFP. So it could be that they're in war zones, they can't move. It could be refugees, internally displaced or externally displaced, people that just have no other way to feed themselves except through the World Food Programme and our partners. So if we don't get our funding, if we don't have access to these people, they have no food. And, you know, that's the reality of the situation.
Sorry, so WFP is like responsible for, that's 30 million people every single day.
Yes.
Wow. And then in the email that you sent me, you were saying that you're going to have to start trying to find a way to get supplies to these areas by setting up, you called it wheels and spoke systems.
Hubs and spokes, yeah. So what we're doing there, now we're always, as far as those people are concerned, we already have a large, the largest logistics force in the humanitarian community. We don't, as WFP, we lead that cluster. So as WFP, we don't just move our food around the world globally.
Right.
We also move supplies and people for the rest of the humanitarian community where needed. So what we're doing as far as COVID is concerned is we're stepping up and we've become the backbone of the COVID response. So we're not moving just our people, our food, but we're moving health workers, personal protection equipment, ventilators, equipment, staff for organizations like UNICEF, health workers, getting them, their people and their equipment to the front line so that they can serve people and save lives. So that's sort of something else that we're doing on our logistics side of our organization.
Wow.
And where the hubs come in is we've set up three global hubs, and from those global hubs we're going to smaller hubs across Africa and Panama and Asia, and then equipment, people, passenger planes will go from there to where it's needed. So that's sort of our hubs and spokes, common services for the COVID response.
That's an incredible undertaking, to put it lightly. So when your organization is already the largest like provider of humanitarian care for food around the world, and then a situation like this comes in and it adds all that extra, but it's not like you can suddenly have extra hands on the ground. And in like, what kind of position does that put you in into trying to find more people to help?
Well, first of all, what we need is in this instance, we're looking for around $1.9 billion initially to pre-position food in fragile countries. So we're hoping to get food to places in the next weeks, months, so that the food is there in the local communities or local region, at least, where it needs to be. So if borders are closed down, that the food is there where it needs to be. And this is money that's generally promised to WFP.
Okay.
So we're looking for people to countries that do support WFP to just step up and give us that money up front that they've already promised. And we can take that flexible funding that they give us and purchase the food either within the region or outside the region and get it where it needs to go. So that's sort of the first thing that we need to do. We're looking to feed 100 million people,
wow.
But there's other ways that we can help those that bigger number that are stepping up, and that is through technical assistance to governments, helping support their safety nets and their social protection, social programs that are already in their countries, and we'll help support them. So things like school feeding programs. We feed around 18 million kids in school feeding programs, and we can help with expertise to step up those school feeding programs on countries that find themselves with an outstanding number or increasing number of hungry people, and how to help them increase their social safety nets. So it might be something that we're doing either with technical support or funding or with food, whichever is sort of needed within that context.
And now what is the bulk of the food that you are sending? Like what is the food make up of? Because I saw on your website that it aims around 31 cents per meal, if that's the right number. So what does that consist of?
Lots of different things. So first of all, just if we take a step back, it's not always food. What we've found is that in some regions, if you think of refugees, Syrian refugees in places like Jordan, Lebanon, what we do there is instead of giving food, we give a debit card, and we upload around $28 onto that debit card per person in the family. And that gives the refugee, that person, the ability to go into a WFP store, or it's a local store that has prices that are standardized, and they're able to choose what food they want. And that enables them to buy fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, eggs, milk, whatever it is that they need, a nutritious diet for their family. It also helps to inject cash into the local economy. That storekeeper now needs to feed, you know, thousands of people where he didn't before. So he'll need new staff. He'll need to reach out to the dairy, to the dairies, to the farmers in his community, and we'll help him inject money into that community. So that has a double whammy effect when we do it that way.
Wow.
So when there's food available in the community or in the region, we can do that, and that's an excellent way of feeding people. And it also gives the beneficiary the dignity of going into a store and choosing food for their family.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then in other situations like school feeding programs, we go out to, where possible, we go out to the local community, to the women that have smallholder farmers, that have smallholder farms. We get the women together to form an association, women-led associations, and we give them the technology, working with our partners, we give them the tools to expand the crops that they are growing, to give them more nutritious crops, better quality crops, and obviously more. And then we can give them a purchase order to purchase that food. Because very often these women have got a small plot of land. A man comes with a truck at the end of the month,
right,
or a couple of times a month, and buys the food off them and takes it off to the market. If they have purchase order from WFP, if they're working together, hundreds of them together, they can sell in bulk to ourselves, to WFP, or to the local markets, to processing plants, etc. So what we're doing there is we're taking that food that we purchase from these women associations and taking that food to their kids at the school feeding program. And that gives us a way to step out of the equation at some point, and they start to not need a school feeding program when the women are making more money in the community and the community is doing better. So it helps us step away from this, but it also is a way of purchasing locally. And again, with that dollar that helps the school feeding program also helps the local farmers in the area. So in that case, we may be supplying maybe some rice or wheat corn to the school and then getting the local vegetables for a nutritious diet for the school feeding program. But then, of course, there are the emergency situations where we have to give a what we call a food basket, where we're saving lives, and we try to purchase that food regionally, so we're helping, again, that local economy. But in cases like floods or severe droughts over a whole region, we have to go that further afield. So then what we do is we make sure we purchase or give the right food that's culturally correct, what the beneficiaries used to eating or the families are used to eating within their community. So that could be dried rice or lentils, beans, corn, whatever that community is used to eating that we're able to give. And I have to say that WFP is a voluntary funded organization.
Wow.
So when we can't give full rations to somebody or to a community, it's because we don't have the funding needed to do so. So that's why we're always looking for funds from the international community in countries like Canada, the US, who are, you know, some of our largest donors, to continue to fund the different programs that we do.
Is it ever challenging to try and to make some of these governments like realize that the work that you're doing is saving the citizens of their countries, and you're going in and really putting the boots on the ground in that situation to try and help these people? Or is it just that there's a lack of government in these places, and so these people are kind of left behind? I know that's a broad question, especially in a place like a conflict zone where citizens are often forgotten in a lot of these places.
Well, to be honest, they're very supportive. We find these countries that we're working with, like Canada, the US, Germany, UK, these are some of our top donors, and they're very supportive of the work of WFP.
Yep.
And they've seen our programs. We have good monitoring systems. They see how we work. So they are very supportive. It is always easier to run a program when you've got the cooperation and the support from the local governments and the local communities. And that's where we obviously have more success. So, but in places, like you say, the conflict zones, where there's no infrastructure or very little infrastructure, then it is extremely difficult because you have to go that extra mile. So in South Sudan, for instance, where there's been conflict on the ground for a while, we're feeding, I think, around over 5.5 million people. And in some cases, what we have to do is airdrops, because there aren't the roads on the ground. A certain time of the year, there's flooding. So any roads that are available to us are flooded and we're not able to get through. So we have to use planes to drop into drop zones. That's extremely expensive, up to 10 times more expensive than taking 30 trucks through to a community. So, you know, you have to think about these contexts, and you add COVID to this, which means at our distribution points now, we're having more distribution points, so less people are turning up to them. We're having hand washing stations, information broadcasts, so the people that do need our support know what's happening and why they should be social distancing, why they should be washing their hands, and we're supporting them in that way.
Wow. So how did you, on a personal note, how did you get involved with the WFP?
Oh, kind of. Mine's not the story you want. My story was sort of by accident. I sort of fell into this, into working with WFP, promoting a walk about 14 years ago. And to be honest, I wasn't that familiar with their work.
Right.
But as soon as I became familiar, as soon as I understood, you know, who I was working with, everything changed. I knew I could not go back to working in the private sector. I was public relations, sales, marketing, and I just turned my back on it. I couldn't do it, and there's just no one else you want to work with after you've worked for an organization like this. My job is easy. I'm talking to Canadians about global hunger, hopefully bringing some information to them about the work that we do and encouraging people to work with our organization to donate to WFP. The real heroes are the ones that are working in the fields, my colleagues that are on the front lines right now who haven't left places like South Sudan or Syria or Yemen, are still there on the ground delivering food every day in conflict zones, making sure people that are hungry, families, children, get fed.
Well, I don't think you should undermine your importance either in trying to spread the word. So what can Canadians do? And I know it's a difficult time to ask that question because everybody's going through their own sort of things right now because of COVID. But what can people do to try and, like you said, spread the word, or if it's donating whatever they could or something like that to try and help these places?
Well, that's it. So spreading the word is essential. We have WFP.org is our website, but we have a number of Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts. WFP Canada is my account that I manage here in Canada. And, you know, talking about World Hunger, sharing some of our posts is all very important. But I know your program is often talking about chefs and two chefs.
Yes.
So people that are interested in food are the people that we want interested in our organization. We run a number of different campaigns throughout the year. Last year, we focused on waste, on food waste. And we spoke to and engaged a number of international, national chefs all around the world, sometimes in the places where we serve in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, and also in Canada and the US and across Europe, looking for chefs who are interested in food waste, are interested in global hunger, balanced diets. This is all subjects that I know chefs are particularly interested in. So anyone that owns a restaurant, that blogs about food, talks about food, they're all people that we really want to engage with on these kind of campaigns. We have, you know, a lot in common. We feed around 15 billion meals a year, and, you know, chefs are out there serving meals to people every day, hoping to have good, healthy food, bringing people together over food. This is something that we do, and, you know, hopefully this is something that chefs would want to work with WFP on.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what I said at the start too is that I came across your agency and what you were doing through social media, and that's why I sent you that initial email, was because I started reading and realizing what was happening and what your organization was doing, and it really struck a chord with me because I'm not feeding people right now, and it's something that I desperately miss. And so we started like a small charity to help hospitality workers in the village where I live in Bayfield. Where we're making food every Friday. But I mean, when you think about the scale and kind of the real issue of feeding people, I think that there's a lot of chefs and a lot of cooks and a lot of restaurateurs in Canada that, I mean, I've been doing this for 15 years, and I found out about your organization last week, which is why I reached out. And so I will do everything I can to help spread the word about it, which is one of the reasons that I was so delighted when you said you'd agree to talk to me. But I really hope that more people find out about the work you're doing. But I think that's a really beautiful sentiment that you said about, you know, you're feeding people, you're trying to bring people together and make sure that you can, well, save lives with food.
Right. I think some of the stories, I was talking to a colleague who was working in Iran and Syria for 3 years, and talking to refugees, telling their stories. And what she heard a lot was that food and the food that we supply them with, whichever form it comes in, really brings them together. It brings the family back together and gives them some sort of hope and remembrance of how they used to be, how they used to live. And it's really important to bring people together that way. So we, you know, we've run a number of campaigns throughout the year, and we need chefs and people interested in food and talk about food to really engage with us and help us with these campaigns in places like Canada and the US.
It's beautiful to think that, like, the food you're providing is, like you said, bringing people together and not just providing sustenance, because food is something more than that. I think the work that your organization does is so noble, and it's astounding to think that there's the possibility of 250 million people are going to need food, that there's people out there like you that work at this organization on the front lines that are trying to help so many people. It makes the perspective of, you know, a chef going into a dinner service in Canada with, you know, 60 heads on the book a little bit. It makes you think about that a little bit more.
I think it does. And I think anybody, from what my colleagues were saying, and I've been to some countries that we work in myself, and when you go into the homes and you see basically an onion on the shelf, that's the last house I went into. I remember there was a father who had four children, And what he said saved him was the fact that the kids went to a school down the road with a school feeding program. They had a morning breakfast and lunch. So he didn't have to worry about that meal five times a day.
Right.
He worked for about $1, $1.50 a day. And when we were in his home, he took us into his home. It really was an onion on his shelf. That was it. That was the food that was in the house for the family. He would buy it daily. And if you think about someone that is told now that he can't leave his home because of COVID, he can't go out to work, he can't mingle with people or, you know, go work in the fields or get that daily rate as a laborer, you know, what does his family do? And the schools are closed.
Right.
So there isn't that school meal that's being distributed to his four small children. So, I mean, luckily in some places we're able to... the teachers, in fact, are actually getting on bikes in Honduras and distributing WFP to families so that they have the food, not on a daily basis, but maybe on a weekly basis to make sure that they're fed. So, you know, we're looking at alternatives of how we're working. And the places that we work are the places that don't have safety nets. We're hopefully putting those into place and helping the local governments out with those, but they don't have the safety nets that they need. So, you know, this is where money is going to. And as I said, we're voluntary funded, and our overhead is 6.5%.
Okay.
So, you know, we're an extremely lean organization. So any dollar given, 93.5% goes to feed people.
Wow.
So that might be why you haven't heard of WFP. We don't have the funds for mass advertising and big campaigns, but it's our resources go to feed people in the field.
Well, I think that speaks volumes. If 93.5 cents out of every dollar is actually being used, that's an amazing number.
It is.
Well, Julie, look, I can't thank you enough for agreeing to talk to me. Like I said,
I want to thank Julie Marshall for speaking with me the other day. I want to thank you for listening to this program, and I just want to reiterate, please follow the WFP on social media. Share their posts. Go to the WFP.org to follow along the work that they are doing. This show will be updating you on what's going on with their campaigns and what they're trying to do to spread the word about everything that they're trying to solve. I want to thank you for listening. Wherever you are, I hope you stay safe and healthy. And as always, I'm Brian Clark. Have a great service and have a great week.